having fun?
You're laughing at me.
Laugh at me because I was the only one to answer.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, that's good. Usually people are a bit shy. Yeah, so how's it going?
Awesome.
Is it all right? Breakfast is good? How about the physics? Is it all right? Great. So, like I said earlier, don't hesitate to come and see me if you have any question or problem. I'm always ready to talk to you. So I'm the lucky guy who gets to teach you relativity, and probably some of this you'll have seen before. How many of you have done a little bit of relativity before as undergrads? Yeah, so first couple of lectures. I don't want to leave anybody behind, obviously. This is a very foundational course. So first couple of lectures, you may see a bit of repetition of what you've seen before, and hopefully then we'll move quickly into things you haven't seen before. I want to recommend a few books. There's about a million books on relativity, so be selective. I guess the one that's probably the best at this level is the book by Sean Carroll. Some of you probably looked at this before. I see people nodding. So that's a nice book. And I recommend that as a sort of basic text on GR. Some of you may have also looked at this book. This is by Steven Weinberg. It's a classic book. It's very old now, very out of date. But it's very good as a sort of compendium or encyclopedia. So if you get stuck on a problem or something seems too messy, then at least that's not a bad place to look. And it's all correct, even though it's from a sort of nuts and bolts point of view. It's not very geometrical, but that's a very nice basic reference. Then I wanted to mention some just fun books. One of them is this book, Richard Feynman's book on gravitation, which is very interesting. It was just some lectures he gave at Caltech in the early 60s. Were only published recently, I think a few years ago. And so somebody, you know, organized the lecture notes and wrote them up. And it's a very, very individual point of view on general relativity, where he looks at general relativity as a particle physicist. And his conclusion is that, you know, what Einstein did was completely amazing when you look at it in terms of particle physics, because he, if you thought about scattering of particles and scattering amplitudes and doing perturbation theory, you would have never guessed that what you were actually doing was geometry. And so what Einstein did is somehow capture all of perturbation theory, resum it all, come up with a single compact formula for all of it. And so he emphasizes just sort of how amazing that was, though in principle, a particle physicist working for maybe about a century could have eventually come up with the same theory. So that's a nice book to look at. You can't do better than going back to Einstein. It's always worth looking at what he wrote. And in fact, that's true everywhere in theoretical physics. If you want to learn about the Dirac equation, read Dirac. I don't recommend Maxwell for Maxwell's equations, except for the pictures, which are interesting. He has some mechanical models which represent the Maxwell equations, and they're very interesting. But for Einstein, he has some popular books on relativity, and this one is called The Special in General Theory, and basically it's a popular book, but explains the principles behind relativity very beautifully. And finally, there's a brand new book. You see, you're very special because you will take relativity in the centenary year. So Einstein's paper on general relativity is 1916, and this is one of the great classics of physics. And so just in time, this book has been prepared. It's called The Road to Relativity, The History and Meaning of Einstein's Paper, called The Foundation of General Relativity. And so it's a whole book, just about one paper. And they reproduce the manuscript, which is handwritten, and then explain every step and all the history and the background. So I'm going to leave this book in the library, and you're welcome to, when you get tired of manipulating indices, come and have a look at that book. It's a absolutely fascinating story of the more or less torture Einstein went through before finally coming up with the right theory, with many, many mistakes along the way. Okay, so that's some background reading for you. As I said, I'm going to, the outline of this course is basically this week, we're going to do a little bit of special relativity review. We will discuss how particles move in a curved space, which was Einstein's basic insight that led him to the laws of gravity. Next week, I hope we'll do Einstein's equations, and maybe if there's time, the action principle for the Einstein equations. And then in the third week, we're going to discuss applications of Einstein equations, including black holes, maybe gravitational waves, and cosmology. And your job is basically to stop me talking about cosmology for as long as you possibly can, because once I start, I won't stop. Okay, so I'm going to postpone the cosmology as long as I possibly can. But of course, that's the really interesting application. Most interesting application of all. So let's begin by talking about special relativity. And its foundation. And so the foundations of special relativity date back to the 1860s when Maxwell discovered the laws of electricity and magnetism. And as I'm going to emphasize, these laws were a clue to the whole of 20th century physics, a very profound clue. It took people decades to understand those clues, but in many ways, they prefigured everything that happened in 20th century physics. So let me go to the manual. Okay, so Maxwell wanted to understand the laws of electricity and magnetism. And those laws were known largely at the time. There was Gauss's law that told you that the divergence of the electric field was the charge density. So this is the charge density. And there was an analogous law for magnetism. And it's important to realize that this equation describes the whole of electrostatics. So if you have a distribution of charges, from this equation, and actually also the equation that the electric field is the gradient of a potential, you can infer all electric fields. And this equation is different because it tells you that there are no sources of magnetic fields. Magnetic fields go through space, but they have no, there are no charges. In some modern theories of field theories, there are magnetic charges called magnetic monopoles, and this is a very interesting theoretical plaything, but so far nobody has found any magnetic monopoles or charges in the universe. Then there is Faraday's law, So Faraday was a brilliant experimentalist who didn't know much mathematics, but he was very interested in what happens if you change these fields. And what he discovered was a relation which Maxwell turned into mathematics, which is that a changing magnetic field creates an electric field. And so if there's no magnetic field, or if it's static, then you have curl E is zero, and then you have that the electric field is the gradient of a potential, and then you get all of electrostatics, because this is now the equation for that potential. And also what was known was Ampere's law, which is that magnetic fields are created by J, and this is the electric current density, and so that's what was known up till Maxwell's time. And what Maxwell did is he realized these equations were inconsistent and actually had to be corrected by adding this term. And so this is called Maxwell's displacement current. And another equation was known, which was the conservation of electric charge, first referred to by Benjamin Franklin, which is that the rate of change of the electric charge density is minus the divergence of the electric current density. And so the way to think about this is that if I have an electric charge, which is integral d3x of rho of x, let's call it rho of t and x. So this is a charge distribution which depends on time and space, then you can see that dq dt, the ordinary derivative of q, q is a function of t, so dq dt is d3x d rho dt, which is minus integral d3x divergence of j. And then we can use the divergence theorem to say this is minus integral j dot ds. And here, I'll just draw a little picture. There's some volume V enclosed by a surface S. So this integral is over the volume, and this integral is over the surface. So this is just saying that the rate of change of the charge inside volume V is minus the flow of the charge across the surface. So the integral of J across the surface gives you the rate at which electric charge is leaving the surface. And so this equation we call local current. Let's call it local charge conservation. So Maxwell knew about these five equations without this term. And Maxwell discovered the extra term that this term, let's call it star, was needed for consistency. Now, the argument looks very simple today, but at the time, very few people knew about partial differential equations, and Maxwell actually invented most of what we call PDE calculus today. And so he really had to work all this out from zero. But today it's rather easy to see what his argument is. You see, let me number these equations. So let's call this 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Now, it's easy to see that 2 and 3 are consistent. Why? Because if I take the divergence of 3, then the left-hand side is the div of a curl, which is identically 0. And the right-hand side, because partial derivatives commute, is d by dt of div b, and that's 0 by 2. So there's no inconsistency between equations 2 and 3. They're perfectly compatible with each other. But if we look at equation 4, look at equation 4 and try to play the same game, div of 4, the left-hand side is 0 by the same argument, because the div of a curl is 0. The right-hand side is equal to mu naught div j, and that's equal to minus mu naught d rho dt. So if the charge density is changing in some region of space, then the divergence of the right-hand side is not 0. And so now we have a contradiction, which we fix by adding this extra term. Okay, so Maxwell's term adds another part to the right-hand side, which is plus mu naught epsilon naught d by dt div e, and then using equation 1, div e is rho over epsilon naught, so this becomes plus mu naught d rho dt, and these two cancel. Okay, so Maxwell found that if he added this extra term, mathematical consistency was then possible. But that extra term led to an amazing consequence. Which is that equations 1 to 4 have wave solutions, even when rho and j are 0. So to see that, if we take take the time derivative, so let's put rho and j equal to 0, take the time derivative of 4, so d2e dt squared. So I'm just taking the time derivative of that last term in equation 4, and that's equal to 1 over mu naught epsilon naught curl of db dt using equation 4. And then using equation 3, this is minus 1 over mu naught epsilon naught curl of E. And then using standard formulae for the curl of curl, and using equation 1 that divi is 0, one finds plus 1 of mu naught epsilon naught grad squared E. So E obeys the wave equation. D2 dt squared minus 1 over mu naught epsilon naught grad squared E equals 0. And this is the wave operator or D'Alembertian. And of course, we have to also have div E equals div B equals 0. So now to Maxwell, it was clear there are exist solutions like the electric field being 0, 0, a function of x minus ct. Where c is equal to the speed of the wave obeys c squared equals 1 over mu naught epsilon naught. Okay, just by dimensions from that equation, you can see that this must be a velocity squared because you need a length squared over a time squared to convert this Laplacian into something with units of d2 by dt squared. So just by dimensions, 1 over mu naught epsilon naught is a speed squared. And just to see that, if this is the electric field, then the magnetic field, this obviously has zero divergence because it's only a function of x. And the third component of the electric field, so when you calculate the divergence, is dEx dx plus dEy dy plus dEz dz. And this is 0 because EX and EY are both 0, and EZ is only depending on X. B, likewise, is 0 minus this function over C, 0. Notice that E and B have different units, and they're related by a speed, because from, let's say, equation 3, E from equation 3, E so E divided by a speed is equal, it has the same dimensions as, sorry, did I get that right? I think I have a C in the wrong place. E should be a speed times B. No, sorry, that is right. Electric field is a speed times the magnetic field. And we can check this satisfies the Maxwell equations because you see curl of E is equal to 0. Now, curl means I take d by d curl in the y component will be d by dz times the x component of this minus d by dx of the z component. And so this will give minus dx f 0. And the partial derivative of b, I get a minus sign from here. And so I get 0. Differentiating that function, I get plus dx f. And the c's cancel. And so we see that curl E is minus dB dt, just as we need to satisfy Maxwell's third equation. And we likewise can check curl B equals 1 over C squared dE dt. Okay, so this is the solution of the Maxwell equation. And if we draw it, you're very familiar with this thing. That here's x, y, z, and then if the z component of the electric field is some kind of pulse, so this is Ez, then the magnetic field is exactly the same shape with a minus sign. And this is By. In fact, I just draw it as E and B. So today this looks pretty obvious, but it probably it was simply incredible discovery at the time, because when Maxwell put the numbers in, and I should say the units I've used are SI. So I should have said that earlier. In SI units. So in SI units, we have coulombs as the electric charge. We have amps. We have Tesla as the magnetic field. And then these constants, mu naught of 4 pi times 10 to the minus 7, by definition, in SI units. And this quantity epsilon naught experimentally is measured as 1 over 4 pi times 1 over 9 times 10 to the 9. And so you can see from this that 1 over mu naught epsilon naught square rooted is approximately 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. So when Maxwell did that calculation using the current units, he got the speed of light to within a few percent and realized that these waves must be light. So that was probably the most amazing discovery physics has ever made. Feynman says in his book about it, perhaps the most dramatic moment in the development of physics during the 19th century occurred to James Clerk Maxwell one day in the 1860s, when he combined the laws of electricity and magnetism with the laws of the behavior of light. As a result, the properties of light were partly unraveled, that old and subtle stuff that is so important and mysterious that it was felt necessary to arrange a special creation for it when writing Genesis. Okay, so the ancients knew that light was pretty amazing stuff, when Genesis was written, they said, "Let there be light." And so Maxwell could say when he was finished with his discovery, "Let there be electricity and magnetism, and there is light." So, discoveries like this do not happen every day. And this realization that light is a wave in electric and magnetic fields continues to have very profound consequences even today. So following this discovery, there was a gradual realization electromagnetism has a set of incredible symmetries. And Maxwell's equations were the clue that physics has symmetry at its heart. But it took people some time to realize it. And I think some of its symmetries are still being, are still clues beyond the physics we know. So, of course, it led to relativity. Why? It led to special relativity. Why? Let me call it special relativity to distinguish it from Galilean relativity. Because the moment you predict a speed, you've done something insane. In Newtonian physics, there is no definite speed, because if something has a speed, I can always move relative to what I'm, how, you know, if I'm standing here and I measure a speed, well, then if I decide to move, the speed I measure is going to be different. So how can you ever predict a speed? Well, that's just what Maxwell did. So it makes no sense from Newtonian or Galilean point of view that you can predict a speed. So that was the clue that gave rise to special relativity, but of course it took people almost 40 years to realize there was something fundamentally wrong with either Maxwell or Newton. And of course, Newton was wrong. So that was a very profound clue. Maxwell's theory also has gauge symmetry, okay, which was the has been the guiding principle for particle physics in the 20th century. And Maxwell's theory was the first example of a theory with gauge symmetry. Again, it took people a while to realize, but it is the archetypal theory where the existence of a massless degree of freedom, which is the photon, is light, is forced on you by a gauge symmetry. And there's more. Maxwell's equations have conformal symmetry. See, conformal symmetry in its most elementary form is just the symmetry under scale. That if you take something and scale it up or scale it down, it's still perfectly valid. So if you rescale time and rescale space, the solution you had to Maxwell's equations is still a symmetry, is still a solution. So that means that not only did Maxwell explain light, immediately he predicted waves of all wavelengths. So an infinite number of solutions of any wavelength, be it from radio waves to X-rays. So you've got an infinite number of solutions. I could take this wave and just rescale it. You see, it's obviously obvious these equations are scale invariant because rescale space and rescale time and leave E and B alone, and you'll see equations 3 and 4 remain unchanged. In fact, there's more that follows from conformal symmetry. If you didn't want to do any calculus and you just wanted to know what's the electric field of a point charge from scale symmetry, actually it's obvious. Because in equation 1, you see charge density has units, well, of course, of charge, divided by length cubed. The left-hand side is div E. So it follows that E has units of charge divided by epsilon naught times 1 over length squared. So what's the electric field of a point particle? There's only one thing which has that scaling property. That's the inverse square law. Okay, so the inverse square law follows from conformal symmetry and of course, rotational symmetry, if you say a charge is is spherically symmetric. So this, again, is a very, very profound clue. And of course, conformal symmetry is a very hot topic these days. It is not fully understood yet how you have a theory with conformal symmetry, which has no scale, and yet scales emerge, physical scales emerge. I think it's extremely appealing that fundamental physics should be conformally symmetric. There should not be any scales in physics. I mean, physics shouldn't be about kilograms, meters, seconds. It should be about information, which doesn't have a length scale. And for that reason, I think probably string theory is wrong. It has a string tension. So that's a sort of fundamental reason to doubt string theory. But nevertheless, string theory exploits conformal symmetry in a different way. And there's probably something in it, even if it isn't the ultimate theory. And then finally, there is a weird symmetry, still not understood what it means for real physics, of electromagnetic duality. You can see from these equations that if you exchange E with B up to a minus sign, you have to put a minus sign in the right place, the equations are symmetric. If this is only if rho equals J equals zero. If there are no electric charges, if there are electric charges and currents, then electromagnetic duality would have to exchange the electric and the magnetic charges. So this is a very profound symmetry, which, again, has led to a lot of contemporary work. But the implications for real physics have not really emerged yet. So basically, Maxwell's theory is a clue. It's the most valuable clue we have, probably, as to the fundamental nature of physics. And it's already given us a vast amount. And basically, when Einstein was talking about, you know, where did relativity come from, he always said it goes back to Maxwell's discovery. So now we want to see this explicitly. So we want to see, we're going to focus on relativity here. And so we have to do a little bit of math to turn those equations into a form in which the symmetry of special relativity becomes apparent. So the idea of special relativity is that you combine space and time into space-time. So just as x are coordinates in space, the x alpha, and sometimes I'm going to write the spatial components as xi. So I is 1, 2, 3, and alpha is 0, 1, 2, 3. So just as the x are coordinates in space and t is the time coordinate, x alpha puts these things together. And I've left the speed of light in there just to emphasize that x alpha is a single object. And so all components of it better have the same dimensions. And so you need the c in there to make sure all the components have the same dimensions. So d alpha, which is d by dx alpha, is the partial derivative. And that's equal to 1 over c d by dt grad. So that's the derivative operator on space-time. And again, I'm going to sometimes write this as dt dI. Then it turns out we need another quantity, which is a 4x4 matrix, which is minus 1, 1, 1, 1, and then zeros everywhere else. And its inverse is eta alpha beta, which is the same matrix. And a clue that we need this object is that we know that the wave operator is going to arise as a consequence of Maxwell's equations. And so obviously, if I write this down, d alpha d beta, what I get is minus 1 over c squared dt squared. That's because these two indices are, by the way, we're always using Einstein summation convention, meaning that repeated indices are always summed. So when you write this down, you mean you sum over all values of alpha and beta. But the only values for which this is not zero is when these two are equal. When they're both zero, you get minus one. When they are equal to x, both equal to one, two, or three, then you get d by dx, or d by dy, or d by dz, or squared. And so this wave operator can just be written as eta alpha beta d alpha d beta. So this sort of motivates introducing this quantity eta. Now we want to simplify the Maxwell equations. By introducing this relativistic notation. And so the first thing we have to do is to get rid of E and B, because E and B are vectors, right? Three vectors. But we want to write the equations in terms of four vectors, like X alpha or D alpha. So how do I combine E and B into something which only has indices alpha? How can I make six things, three components of E and three components of B, into one object which only has indices alpha? What do I do? I've got six objects, and I want to put them into something. Can I put them into a field, a four-component field vector? No. So what's the next thing I could try? Anti-symmetric tensor, right? So if I write F alpha beta, this, unless I impose something on it, is going to have 16 components, a 4x4 matrix. It's going to have 16 components. But if I say that F alpha beta is minus F beta alpha, it's an anti-symmetric matrix, then automatically, I set all the diagonal elements equal to zero, right? Because it has to be anti-symmetric. And then there are six components up here. And the ones down here are just the minus of those ones. And so you have 6 degrees of freedom. So 6 degrees of freedom in an anti-symmetric tensor. And so that is very suggestive that you need to combine E and B into an anti-symmetric tensor in relativity. So we're going to try the following. F alpha beta is equal to, and then zeros down the diagonal, minus EX over C, minus EY over C, minus EZ over C, BZ minus BY dx. And then on this side, just the opposite. Sine or F0i is equal to minus EI over C, and Fij is equal to epsilon ijk bk. Okay, so epsilon is the totally anti-symmetric tensor with epsilon 1, 2, 3 equal to 1. So what we'll see is that we are going to be able to rewrite all of Maxwell's equations just in terms of this quantity F, and that will, and then we will forget about electric and magnetic fields and just deal with F. So I want to leave Maxwell's equations there, so I'll bring down that one. Now, we can use eta alpha beta to raise indices. Okay, so I wrote F there with two lower indices, but F with raised indices is defined this way, eta beta nu F mu nu. Okay, so all eta is doing is putting some minus signs in the right places. A very important minus signs. But if I write this as a matrix, I get 0 ex over c, ey over c, ez over c, because that row is row 0, and the columns are 1, 2, 3. So you have a single 0 here. So eta 0, 0 gives you a minus sign. So obviously, you change the sign of the E. But in the magnetic terms, you don't change anything because they involve space. And the sign of eta is plus 1 on space coordinates. And then we have the negative on the other side. So we have this field strength tensor with two lowered indices and the same thing with two raised indices. And the final thing we need to do is to define the 4 current instead of the 3 current. So J alpha, which will be in the spatial components, the electric current density. But in the time component, we're going to put the electric charge density, and then we'll put the speed of light here to make the units agree, just as we did with the space-time coordinates. Okay, then it turns out that d alpha f alpha beta. So that's the obvious thing you can write down in relativity, the first derivative of the field strength tensor with these indices contracted. It's got to be a vector, and it turns out it's minus mu naught j beta. So equations 1 and 4 are equivalent to these four equations. You see equation 1, is a single equation. Equation 4 are three equations. So you put together those equations into these four equations. One of them will have the zero component will have rho, and the other components will have j, spatial j. And so let's just check this. So what we see is we have, if I take the zero component, so beta equals zero, I get di fi zero. See, I can't have alpha being zero because beta is zero. So if alpha is zero, this is going to be the left-hand side will be zero. So when you sum, you sum alpha only over the spatial components. Now, fi zero, I read the I read the ith row and the zeroth column. And so that gives me minus div E over C, because I take the spatial derivative and sum them all up. And on the right-hand side, and then the right-hand side, I've got minus mu naught rho C. And so the equation implies that div E equals mu naught c squared rho, which is 1 over epsilon naught rho. So you get the right, you get Gauss's law. Similarly, we can check beta equals I. And we now we do get the zero component, d0 f0 I plus dj fj I. And now I've got to use f0 I, so that means the zeroth row and the ith column. So I get ei dot over c. Let me write it as dt. I'll write it as d naught. Plus, and then this thing is dj epsilon j I k b k. That, of course, is dt e I over c squared, because d naught is 1 over c, d by dt, minus curl b I. To see that, I have to flip this index, so I have to flip the I and the j, and then so I have minus curl b in that term. And this is equal to, according to the equation, minus mu naught j I. And so, is that true? Well, you can see curl B is mu naught J. And then, of course, if I pull this term to the other side, I've got dE dt times epsilon mu naught. This term is epsilon naught mu naught. So again, we verify the other equation. OK, so that's really very neat. We turn two equations into one. And this was one of the clues that actually led to relativity's discovery, that you can write the equations in a simpler form, but if you write them in space-time. What about equations 2 and 3? Equations 2 and 3 turn out to be equal to this equation. It looks a little bit mysterious at first, but in fact, because f is antisymmetric, this is equivalent to d gamma f alpha beta, all antisymmetrized. Okay, so antisymmetrizing means you've got three objects. There should be six permutations. You write all the permutations down. And then the odd permutations have a minus sign, and the even ones have a plus sign. And so this equation is completely equivalent to that equation. Alternatively, you can write it as epsilon alpha beta gamma delta. This is a four-dimensional version of epsilon. Okay, so the definition of epsilon is that epsilon 0, 1, 2, 3 is plus 1, and then even permutations are plus 1, and odd permutations are minus 1. Okay, so if I give you any particular permutation, let's say I have, 2, 1, 0, 3. Is that an even or odd permutation? How many permutations do I need to do to get back to this? Okay. So the easy way to do it is to write this thing down and draw lines. And there are three intersections, so it's odd. Okay, so that's the epsilon tensor in four dimensions. I'm not going to check all of this. I think I'll just leave this as an exercise. So check these give. See, in this form, it's obvious that there's four equations, because this alpha is the free index. So alpha can be 0, 1, 2, or 3. So there are only four equations. In this form, it looks like you might have 64 equations, right? 4 by 4 by 4. But there are only four independent equations because of the symmetries of the left-hand side. So there are four equations, and they're precisely the four equations 2 and 3. And in order to do that, you'll need some, you will need to use some identities. One of them is that epsilon ijk, epsilon klm, where I've summed over k. So I'm sure you've seen this formula before, is delta il delta j m minus delta I m delta j l. You've seen that formula before? And similarly, if you contract two indices, ijk epsilon jk m, this is 2 delta I m. This one actually follows from that one. So if you use these formulae, you will, after a little bit of algebra, verify that equations 2 and 3 are equivalent to this equation. See, this equation is obviously equivalent to that equation, because if I took this and antisymmetrize, then the only components which are here are not affected by summing over an a completely anti-symmetric tensor, epsilon. Okay, so a consequence of this equation is that F can be, or F alpha beta can be written as the gradient of a potential. And so in electromagnetism, we're familiar with introducing an electrostatic potential, phi, and the electric field is the gradient of phi. And we're also familiar with a magnetic potential for the magnetic field so that B is curl A. In special relativity, you combine those two things into a single four-vector potential. So E is, so in electrostatics, electrostatics, the electric field is minus grad phi. In magnetostatics, the magnetic field is curl A. And to get the dimensions right, phi and A also differ by a C, just as E and B differ by a speed. So when you combine them into a four-vector potential, it has to take that form. That's with this index mu raised. And with the index lowered, you use eta to lower the index, and that gives an extra minus sign in the time component. Okay, and so from this, you get, so here's our four-vector potential. We write F mu nu is D mu A nu minus D nu A mu. Okay, so the statement is that this equation, meaning that in this four-dimensional curl of F being zero, means that F can be written as a gradient locally, and that's called the Poincaré lemma. And so you can always write F as this anti-symmetric derivative of A. And what you find from this is that B is curl A, and E is equal to minus grad phi. And then there's an extra term, which is necessary when you do time-dependent situations, dA dt. Okay, so these are the usual formula you'll find in Jackson's book, for example, for the electric, for the relationship between the magnetic potential A and the electrostatic potential phi and the electric and magnetic fields. Okay, so we've reduced all of electromagnetism to two equations now. dF is J, and this anti-symmetrized derivative of F is zero. So are there any questions? So that's great. We have almost nothing to remember about electromagnetism. just that, just these two equations. D alpha f alpha beta is minus mu naught j beta, and epsilon alpha beta gamma delta d beta f gamma delta equals zero. Okay, so this is all of electromagnetism. Now, a couple of things to notice about this. You notice that F occurs with raised and lowered indices. Okay. In one equation, it's raised. In the other one, it's lowered. So you can't get away with just having F with all lowered indices. You really need that eta in order to unify these equations. There's no way to avoid that. Then the second key point is these are tensor equations. Okay, just like in classical mechanics, when you write down a tensor equation, you might write down F equals ma as mx mx double dot is equal to minus the gradient of the potential. Okay, so the indices match up. And if you write down an equation like this in mechanics, you know that the equations are rotationally invariant, right? Because under rotations, xi goes to xi prime, which is some orthogonal matrix times xj. And if I want to find this equation in the new coordinates, all I do is apply an O. And then I'll get mx prime double dot is gradient prime of the potential. So you know that the equations of classical mechanics are rotational invariant if you can, because you can write them in tensor form. So as soon as you see you could write Maxwell's equations in tensor form, it immediately tells you they're invariant under something like a rotation. Okay, so and in fact, so these are tensor equations. And therefore, invariant under coordinate transformations, certain coordinate transformations on space-time. So Einstein said in 1916 that the theory of relativity has been developed from electrodynamics as an astoundingly simple combination and generalization of the hypotheses on which electrodynamics was built. So in a sense, it didn't involve anything new. It just involved looking at these equations and saying, voila, they must have a symmetry. Okay, so what is the symmetry? The symmetry is just like rotations in Newtonian mechanics. We can change coordinates. So x goes to x prime, which is some matrix lambda. So this is a constant matrix. Something like a rotation matrix. And of course, anything with an upstairs index, we're going to change in the same way. And F has two upstairs indices, so we're going to change both of them. Etc. From this equation, it follows that d by dx alpha is equal to lambda beta alpha d by dx prime beta, because if you remember the chain rule for partial derivatives, d by dx is dx prime dx times d by dx prime, and dx prime dx is this matrix, right? Because from this it follows that dx prime alpha dx beta, let's say, is lambda alpha gamma. Now I've got to differentiate that, so it's dx gamma dx beta. And the derivative of the coordinate with respect to itself is given by delta gamma beta. Differential of x with respect to y gives 0, but x with respect to x gives 1. So this is equal to lambda alpha beta. So this gives the x prime, the x derivative in terms of x prime, and so it follows that d by dx prime alpha is the inverse matrix of this one times d by dx beta, where lambda alpha beta, lambda twiddle beta gamma is delta alpha gamma. So this is the inverse of lambda. And similarly, lambda beta alpha, lambda twiddle gamma beta equals delta gamma alpha. So matrix inverse is the inverse on the left or the right. And that's what this matrix lambda twiddle is. So the rule is, the rule, upstairs indices transform with lambda, and downstairs indices transform with lambda twiddle, which is the inverse of lambda. Actually, I will use this one. So quantities with indices contracted, e.g., contracted means summing over one upper and one lower index. Well, if you transform these quantities, then you're going to get lambda from the upstairs index, lambda twiddle from the downstairs index. So alpha gamma, A gamma, B delta, delta. Alpha, and then of course lambda with lambda twiddle just gives delta gamma, delta delta gamma, and so this is equal to A gamma B gamma. So indices which are summed over don't transform under Lorentz transformations. Now the one spanner in the works, so these are tensor equations. The one spanner in the works in ensuring they are invariant is those equations implicitly involve eta, right? As I said, first equation is upstairs indices, the second equation is downstairs indices. They involve eta. So in order for the Maxwell equations to be invariant, we must insist, we must impose that eta is invariant, i.e. Eta alpha beta prime, which is the transform of eta, okay, so when you transform eta using this matrix, it has to be the same as it was before. Okay, because an eta is implicit in those equations, and I want the same equations to be valid with the same eta. Okay, so I have to insist that eta is invariant. And this reduces the set of lambdas. This reduces the set of lambdas to the Lorentz transformations. And we usually say that eta is an invariant tensor. So some properties of the lambda. Well, that equation I could write as lambda eta lambda transpose equals eta. That's the first. That's the consequence of saying that eta is an invariant tensor. That is the statement that eta is an invariant tensor. It follows from this that the determinant of lambda squared equals 1. Why? Because the determinant of a product of matrices is the product of the determinants, and the det of eta is minus 1, so you get minus 1 on both sides. Det of lambda and det of lambda transpose are the same, so the square of det lambda is 1, and so det lambda has to be plus or minus 1. And this already tells you that that the group of Lorentz transformations is disconnected. There's part of the group that's connected to the identity, so that would have determinant 1. There's another part that has determinant minus 1. What about the epsilon tensor? Because we also use that. Epsilon alpha beta gamma delta prime. And so this is lambda alpha lambda beta lambda gamma lambda delta mu nu rho sigma epsilon mu nu rho sigma. So that's the transformation law of epsilon. And I better insist that the epsilon is also invariant. It's a consequence that's invariant, because if you look at this formula, this is the formula for the determinant of lambda, okay? So this equals epsilon mu nu rho sigma times det lambda. Okay, this is one definition of a determinant, is I take the appropriate antisymmetric epsilon, contract it with the matrix, and this defines the determinant of lambda. So if det lambda is 1, then epsilon. So epsilon is invariant up to a sign. And the sign doesn't matter anyway, because there's no right-hand side in that equation. So you conclude that the Maxwell equations are invariant under these transformations. Any questions? Oh, sorry. Sorry, here? Oh, mu nu rho sigma. Oh, sorry, yeah. What have I done? Sorry. Yeah, thank you. Epsilon, alpha, beta, gamma, delta. Thank you. Okay, so the statement is that if det lambda is 1, epsilon is invariant. If det lambda is minus 1, epsilon flips sign. Okay, but that doesn't actually matter for Maxwell's equations. If there were magnetic monopoles, then it would matter, okay? Because there would be a J on the right-hand side. And so there would be some issue there. Okay, so now we're just going to work out some examples of these lambdas and see that they lead to all the consequences of special relativity. Okay, so the simplest example of a Lorentz transformation is just a rotation that we're completely familiar with, where if I say lambda alpha beta is a matrix which is 1 in the time-time component, and and then within this block, so let's put zeros everywhere, except in the central block. So there's a central 2x2 block, and in that block, cos theta, sine theta, minus sine theta, cos theta. So that you'll recognize as a rotation around the z-axis by angle theta. And so this is a rotation about z-axis by theta. And so this produces x prime is x cos theta plus y sine theta. Y prime is y cos theta minus x sine theta. And this is an orthogonal matrix. So when you look at this equation, you see if the eta was just 1s, which it is for spatial indices, this equation just becomes O transpose equals 1. And so for any orthogonal matrix in these three coordinates, this is a valid Lorentz transformation. More interesting is a boost, which involves time. And so here we have lambda alpha beta. Now we have to take care of the minus sign in the eta. And this changes the cosine and sines to cosh's and sinh's. One, one, zero, zero, zeros everywhere else. So this is a boost involving the spatial x coordinates and the time. And what you can check is that this satisfies this equation, lambda eta lambda transpose is one, because I need only focus on the 2x2 matrix up here, because everything else is trivial. So I have C minus S C. And then I have the eta matrix. And then I have the transpose of this guy, which is still minus S C. And if I work this out, you will find it's minus C squared plus S squared. And C squared minus S squared, 0, 0. And that's equal to minus 1, 1. So because of that minus sign, the only the matrix which works has this cosh instead of instead of cosine and sinh instead of sine. And so here we have CT prime is equal to CT cosh theta, right? Remember the formula x prime alpha, which is CT xyz. And this is equal to lambda alpha beta x beta. So from this formula, you can read off that the time component changes as follows, minus x sinh theta. And the space component minus CT sinh theta. And so this is, which is called the Lorentz transformation. Or actually a Lorentz boost. So I think in view of the time, I'm going to stop there. We will work out some consequences of this boost. And I believe one of your problem sets, is that today? Tomorrow. Problem class tomorrow will be working out the transformation properties of electromagnetic fields under these boosts and seeing how all that works. So are there any questions for the moment? Yeah.
So when we look at these transformation symmetries, then we can always do a translation as well, right? So we
that's
can
right.
use the full Fock rule.
No, that's right. So in fact, later on, one can prove the following statement, that your transformation matrix is that, right? So if I say x prime alpha is any function of the coordinates. Okay, that's the most general coordinate transformation you could make, is that the new coordinates are any function of the old coordinates. And by the way, when I write this, it looks a bit weird because the indices don't match. But often we do this just to indicate that the function isn't a function of these other things. All right? This is not an index for transforming. It's just functional dependence. Okay, so the new coordinate can be any defined by any four functions of the old coordinates. Then we call this thing the transformation matrix. It's the partial derivative of the new coordinates with respect to the old coordinates. Now, if you define the yes, so then you can ask the question, what is the most, what is the most general, coordinate transformation such that dx prime alpha dx beta dx prime gamma dx delta eta beta delta equals eta alpha gamma. What is the most general coordinate transformation such that eta is an invariant? Okay, so that's a well-defined question. I mean, you might worry, you know, why did we choose linear coordinate transformations up there? Why did I say x prime depends linearly on x? It was an arbitrary assumption. Okay, I did it in analogy with rotations, which are linear transformations, but I didn't really justify it. So what you could do is say, what is the most general coordinate transformation which is compatible with this equation? And then actually, I was going to prove, if I have time, I will prove this. You can prove that the most general one is that x prime alpha is a constant matrix. So in other words, linear plus a alpha, where these are constants. Independent of x. Okay, so the most general coordinate transformation which preserves eta involves Lorentz transformations and translations. These are just translations. And the combined, do you know what this combined group is? The lambda and a parameterize the Poincaré group. Okay, so in quantum field theory, for example, the Poincaré group is a very, very fundamental thing. The Poincaré group is the most general set of coordinate transformations that preserve eta. And it's not hard to show there are six parameters in these lambdas. Let's see if we can see that, see why that's true. Yes. So if you look at this equation, a priori, you might say lambda has 16 parameters, right? It's a 4x4 matrix. Looks like it could have 16 independent components. But the number of equations you're imposing here, which are 10. Why? Because eta is a symmetric matrix, okay? And this equation is symmetric. So there are really only 10 equations. So you have 16 parameters, you impose 10 equations, you're left with 6 free parameters. So this guy has 6 parameters, and this has 4, because there are 4 different constant A's you could add. So the Poincaré group is 10-dimensional. And that's the most fundamental group in relativistic quantum theory. Okay, so this is a theorem, that the most general x prime satisfying this equation has to be linear, plus constants. Yeah?
So this box equation here on the middle board, so I think that's saying that,
which one?
The middle, yeah. F is like a closed form. Then
exactly.
You apply the Poincaré limit to get the F is the exterior derivative of A, right?
Absolutely.
But I think... to use that theorem, you need to know that the space is contractible. So what if your space-time had a hole in it? Does that mean you can't?
Yes. So the case where this goes wrong is actually a magnetic monopole. Okay, so if you have no magnetic monopoles, then there is no there's no right-hand side here. And if you Minkowski space is perfectly contractible. And so this is the theorem in Minkowski space. If there's no right-hand side in that equation, and You know, so you could have some problem with space-time. Let's say there was a wormhole or something that would bring flux in. But the monopole is a classical example where it goes wrong. So one way of sort of thinking about that is imagine that there's really a delta function on the right-hand side there. Okay, so at some particular point, this equation fails. And now you try to write a vector potential for a magnetic monopole, a magnetic vector potential for a monopole, and it fails. So what happens is if you do have a monopole, the best you can do, this is what Dirac did, is to put a string in the vector potential. So the vector potential can exist everywhere on a sphere except, say, at one of the poles, and there's a string. And so Dirac's picture was that the magnetic flux comes in this tube and then spreads out, but he noticed that this tube of magnetic flux would be invisible. And then Yang, it was C.N. Yang and someone else, Wu and Yang, replaced this picture by saying that what you do is on one hemisphere, you put one vector potential, let's call it A plus, and on the other hemisphere, you put A minus, and then you have some overlap region between northern and southern where you have transition functions between them. And so you could cover all of space with a single magnetic vector potential, with different coordinate charts where in which the magnetic vector potential was different. Okay, and so that's essentially how you describe magnetic monopoles. I mean, that's probably the nicest description of magnetic monopoles. But it requires two charts of magnetic vector potentials. If there are no magnetic charges and we're just in Minkowski space, there's never any problem with that equation.
But more generally, you could have like a missing point in space without talking about monopoles, magnetic monopoles.
You could, but it would be, I mean, I think the magnetic monopole is the simplest case, where I delete a point and then from space, and I put a boundary condition is that there's a magnetic field coming out of that point. I mean, if there was nothing coming out of that point, it wouldn't be a problem. But the magnetic monopole is the classic problem where this equation doesn't, where you cannot write down a vector potential covering all of space. So this resolution of that, if you wanted to include magnetic monopoles or such singular points, the resolution of it is that you have to use different coordinate charts on space. And in each coordinate chart, you would have a different magnetic potential. But it's not, you know, if this equation is valid everywhere and you're just in flat space with no points missing, then there's never a problem. Any other questions? Okay, so I shall see you tomorrow.